School for Christian Scientists, a boarding school in the south of England. They were lifted right out of this false sense of environment. My eldest son was very near to them, and he could visit them. So they had a nice sense of family. And they were shown so much love and devotion from all the staff and their friends and their parents and everyone that they met. I remember the first time we visited that school. My little girl, the youngest one, was only 9, and she was holding my hand and she said, "Mommy, isn't it beautiful here? Isn't it just like heaven?" So they were lifted completely out of that, and I was left free to enter into the public practice of Christian Science. And as John has told you, a Christian Science practitioner is simply someone like me who is a student of Christian Science. But because of circumstances in our lives, we've been forced to really apply its teachings and to turn to God in prayer. And because we're so grateful for the benefits that we have received, we dedicate our lives to helping others do the same thing. And Christian Science is a way of life. We turn to it for all our problems, not just physical disease, but relationship problems. Young people use it for exams. People use it for their business problems, financial problems, all sorts of problems. We work out together. I was thinking about the times that Jesus lived in. They weren't so very different to ours. They had wars and rumors of wars. They had drug addiction. They had all sorts of terrible diseases. They had lack, poverty, unemployment, bad housing conditions. The master Christian, Christ Jesus, in his 3 short years of his ministry, healed so many of these problems. He didn't tell people, "Wait until you die, and then it'll be okay." He healed them. His 3 years of ministry were helping to establish the kingdom of heaven right here on earth. Not just for his day and his time, but for all time to come. And that's what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be his disciples, his followers. And we too must be helping to establish the kingdom of heaven right here on earth. And we begin by saying, "I refuse to let anything disturb me or distress me. I'm going to trust God with all my problems. I'm going to be undisturbed. I'm going to turn to him. I know he's the creator of all." And what sort of God would he be if he created all but didn't look after it? He is a God of love and loves his creation. Now, Mary Baker Eddy, when she was a very young child, went through many, many years, or since she was a young child, many years of poor health, of sickness. Indeed, she had to be taught at home by her brother because she wasn't able to attend school. But she always had a deep love for the scriptures and for God and for a search after truth. When she was a young woman, she married. Her husband died in the war, and she was left with a little boy to bring up all alone. Her mother had died, her dearest brother had died. She had no money and she had no hope. And because of her ill health, her little boy had to be fostered out. And the people who were his foster parents became so fond of this little boy that they took him away. And she never even saw him again until he was a grown man. Can you imagine what it was like for her? Or what her environment was like? And yet, in spite of all that, she still went on with her search for God, for her search for truth, to find out and discover what God was like. Because she realized when she really could see that clearly, she would know what she was like, because she was made in His image and likeness. But she would also know what everybody else was like. And after she'd had a wonderful healing herself through simply reading the New Testament and a healing of the Masters, she began to feel that there was a science behind this. How did Jesus heal? And so for several years, she cut herself off from society. She studied nothing but the Bible and concordances to the Bible and commentaries on the Bible in this search for truth. And in the end, when she got all her pages and manuscripts all together, she wrote this book, Science of Health, with Key to the Scriptures. If anyone here this evening doesn't have a copy of this book, you can obtain one from any one of the ushers, or you can buy your own copy. And I can assure you that it will be the best investment that you've ever made. It certainly was for me as a young woman. It's called Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. It truly is a key to the Scriptures and opened them up for me. Now, this sense of environment that we're talking about, being encircled, doesn't end simply with people, events, and circumstances in our lives. It goes out to nature, to everything that's in the earth and in the heavens, and all that the heavens include, the moon and the stars, and beyond that. Beyond anything you and I could at present imagine. It covers the whole earth and everything in the earth and everything under the earth and everything under the seas. And I think that if we really care for our environment or want to care for it, the best way to care for it is to pray daily with the Lord's Prayer. And while we're including all people, we can include the whole earth and all that it contains. And then we will see that our Father is its Father too. And He will care for each little creature, each animal, each tree, each plant. He cares for all. The God who made these perfect, beautiful roses made all, and He maintains them all and cares for them all. Now, I learned a lesson about this some years ago. My family and I had moved to another house, and this house was again on the front of a main road. I seem to like houses on the front of a main road. But this house hadn't been lived in for a long time, and it was in a very run-down condition. Hadn't been lived in for about 5 years. And before that, a very elderly lady had lived in it and had been sadly neglected. But we bought it at a price that we could afford and saw a lot of promise in the house. But on the day that we moved into the house, although it was the 1st of April, it was snowing. It was freezing. The house was full of workmen. All the floorboards were up. The house was being rewired, central heating put in, and a whole new kitchen. And when the furniture van came with all the furniture, there was nowhere to set it because the floorboards were up. And the men had to leave it outside and wrap it up in plastic covers. And in the middle of all this chaos, and I was beginning to feel that I'd made a dreadful mistake in taking on a challenge like this. And one of my sons, a teenager, was looking out the window. And he said, "Mom, what are you going to do about the garden?" And I said, "The garden? Paul, the garden is the least of my worries right now." He said, "Well, Mommy, you love the garden. And it's now the 1st of April. And if you don't do something about it now, you won't have a nice garden to sit in the summer." I said, "It'll take me the summer to sort this lot out. And I will sit in here and buy myself a houseplant." But as the day went on, I began to think about this. And I thought, "Now listen, Myrtle, get this straight. You have been saying that God is caring for you and yours. He's caring for your family. He's caring for the finances. He's caring for the workmen and everything that goes on inside this house. Do you think that his love stops at your front door? Because if you think that, you're in trouble." And I thought, well, no, his love embraces all. So it must embrace the garden. And I know that he is the greatest architect, the greatest landscape designer that ever there was. And he has a wonderful plan for that garden. And I can trust it to him. And then I gave myself a little mental pat on the back, because at least I had prayed about it. But have you ever noticed that God's timing and ours differ? Because about half an hour after that, the door knocked, and I went out, and my neighbors, they were semi-detached houses, and my neighbors were on the doorstep, a young couple, and they brought me a lovely canister of tea to welcome me to the neighborhood. And I brought them into all the chaos, and I said, "I hope the noise isn't too much for you." And they said, "Oh no, we're so delighted to have neighbors after all these years, and you can make as much noise as you like." So as they got up to go, the husband said to me, "What are you going to do about the garden?" And I said, "Father, get off my back. This is too soon for me." I said, "Well, we're thinking about it." And they said, "Well, don't think too long, because it'll soon be the summer." And they said, "Look, we are both lecturers at a nearby university. We've got 2 weeks off for Easter. And we wondered if you would be offended if we offered to do your garden for you as a housewarming gift, because we love gardening." And I said, "Would I be offended? I would be delirious if you would do my garden." So they said, "Oh, that's great. We'll start tomorrow right away. You order a big skip to take away all the rubbish." And we walked out to the door, and they said, "How would you like the garden?" And there was an old broken fence between us both, lying in my garden. It was all rotten. And I said, well, since there are only two of us, wouldn't it be nice if we had a sense of oneness, a roundness? And they jumped up and down. They said, we hope somebody would say that. And I said, what about the old hedges which were falling out onto the road? And I said, well, we'd pull all those out and have a nice rockery. And that would mean that the people who were walking by or on the buses would have a nice view and they could enjoy the garden. And they said, that's how we saw this garden as well. So they said, we'll go to a nearby beach and get you stones for your rockery. Well, they started that very night. They drove to the beach and they made 9 trips. And they picked me out all these beautiful stones for the rockery. The next day, the big container came and my son and I went out to help them to clear out the hedges and cut the grass, which was up to about here. And I noticed that as the skip filled up, that my young neighbor had pulled out an old rose tree and he'd thrown it on the skip. Now, I've got a soft spot for roses. So I went over and took it out of the skip, and it looked dead, was full of weeds and grass, and I began to clean it. And my neighbor said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm cleaning out that old rose. He said, sure, it's dead. And I said, well, I like old roses. He said, it's too old for your garden. Even if it lived, it would spoil your nice garden. Its roots are too big and it's too old. And I said, I don't care if it is too old or it looks dead, it's going in my garden. So they said, okay. Now, I didn't tell him, but I had been asked to pray for a lady who was suffering from old age. She was quite an old age, and she thought she was too old, and that she was a nuisance to her family, and it was time she took off. And I had been asked to pray for her. Now, with everything that was going on in my life, I was inclined to agree with her. And I began to think, well, she's had a good innings after all. But then I thought, that's not very kind. And it certainly isn't scientific. So I prayed that God would help me to see that old age is a disease, a pernicious disease, like any other disease, and it can be cured. And I prayed very humbly that God would help me to see that. That because God doesn't grow old, if God is spirit and life and truth and love, they don't grow old. God knows nothing about old age, any more than he knows about wars or disease or disasters. And I prayed that he would help me to see that. And I knew that the love that was caring for this woman and me to help me to see that was also caring for the rose. The same love made us all and would maintain and care for us all. Well, the weeks went by and I prayed for the woman and I prayed for the rose. But there was no sign of life at all from the rose and very little from the woman. And one day her son rang me to say he had bad news, that his mother had been very ill for the last few days. They'd been up all night and it looked like she was passing on. And he told me all the symptoms and he said, I think I'd better call in a doctor. And I felt very disappointed, but I said, you must do what you feel's right. Now, I still had workmen in the house, and I didn't want them to see that I was having a little cry. So I went out into the garden, and I looked at the rose, and there were 3 dead sticks above the earth. And I pulled it out of the ground in disgust. And I said, just look at you. You're dead as a doornail. And do you know that underneath the ground were dozens of little white shoots and two little green leaves just ready to spring above earth? Well, I kissed those little shoots and the baby leaves and put it back into the ground and stamped it with my feet to make it nice and tight and said, thank you, Father, for that lesson, for teaching me never to give up just because I couldn't see something happening on the surface. And I knew that what was true for the rose was true for the woman, no matter what appeared to be going on the surface, that I couldn't be taken in by it. Well, suddenly my neighbor, who was looking through his window, came running out, and he hated this rose. And he said, what are you doing? I thought I saw you take that rose out. He said, I thought you'd given up. I said, you just leave it. I didn't tell him what it seemed. He said, by the way, your phone's ringing. So I ran in, and this woman's son was on the phone. He said, I don't know what's happened to my mother. She's sitting up on the edge of the bed. She said, I've neglected her for 2 days. I haven't fed her. She's starving. She wants a big bowl of porridge. And she wants washed and dressed. She has work to do. And that was the end of the problem. And in the summer, when the rose came to bloom, there were lovely yellow roses. Two roses came out, first of all. And the first night that I saw them, my neighbor's door was open. It was a summer evening. And I cut off the rose and put it in a little vase. And they were having dinner in the kitchen. And I went in and I said, there's the rose that you said was too old and too ugly for my garden. Well, just smell that. And he agreed. It had a beautiful perfume. And I said, you know, no rose in my garden, not all those new ones, have the same perfume as that rose has. It's sweeter. And the other rose I brought to my friend. And while I'm on the subject of garden and roses, at this point I always say to people, if my talk inspired you tonight, that I hope you take whatever bit you got the most from and put it into practice in your life until you've proved it and demonstrated it. Because if you visited me at my home and I had a nice plant and you liked it and you asked me for a little cutting and I gave it to you and you took it home and you planted it and you watered it and you loved it and cared for it, it would grow, it would thrive, then you would give your friends cuttings and they would give their friends cuttings. It would keep on going. But if you took it home and you said, oh, it's too dark out there and it's cold and I don't feel like getting out a shovel tonight, and you just threw it in the backyard, it would die. Well, it wouldn't be my fault, and it wouldn't be the rose's fault. So if this lecture died, it's not my fault, and it's not the lecturer's fault, it's not the lecturer's fault, it would be your fault. But the next time I see you, I'll ask you how it's doing. Because I expect you all to plant it. Now, I know the time is getting on, and I'm over my time. And I usually tell a different experience. But because of the situation in the Gulf, I want to change that story tonight. Because I started the lecture by talking about terrorists and terrorism and how difficult I found it to forgive the IRA. Well, believe me, I've learned so many experiences through the IRA that I now feel that I owe them a debt of gratitude. So I'd like to share a story with you, but if you feel it's gone on too long, and his brother go home. What about it? No? No. I didn't think you would. I hoped you wouldn't. Well, I'll proceed to tell you this experience. I don't know if you remember seeing in your televisions the H block when we had what was called the dirty protest or the blanket protest. The H block is a big prison in Belfast where the IRA and loyalist prisoners are imprisoned. And several years ago, the IRA Republican prisoners in there didn't like the conditions in the jail. They were demanding a lot more rights and so forth. And they went on a fast, a hunger fast, and were determined to fast to the death to get what they wanted. Now, this was shown in our televisions and throughout the world, day in and day out. Two men at last died, two of the men on the fast, and it had got to such a stage that they had painted the walls with their own human dirt. And we were wearied of it. We were tired listening to it. And one night I was going to bed very late, and I turned on the radio and I heard a news bulletin, and it said a third IRA hunger striker was about to die, that he had lost the sight of his eyes and was only given a few more days to live. And I remember thinking, let him die. Let the whole lot of them die. That would be less of a problem for us. That would be one way to get rid of them. Now, I justified my anger by remembering the things that they had done. The little children who'd lost limbs or been blown to pieces, and the people who were left without fathers and mothers and homes and businesses, the destruction that they caused. I really felt that my anger was justified. Now, I'm supposed to be a Christian Science practitioner, someone who shows mercy and compassion. But that night, that's how I was thinking. Well, I didn't think much more about it, but soon after that, this hunger strike finished. And for some reason, that man didn't die. We weren't told why he didn't die. But several months after that, I was preparing to go to church one Sunday morning, and I had put on the radio, and they were interviewing groups of terrorists who'd been in prison on both sides of our community. And I knew two of these prisoners that they were interviewing because I had worked with them in the prison. And these were men who had found religion in the prison and who wanted to change their way of life. And they'd formed a little group called the Soldiers of the Cross. And they wanted to help young people to stay out of these organizations, not get caught up in them. And they were doing a lot of good things in the community. So I was really interested in this program. But I wasn't prepared for what happened at the end of it, because they interviewed a young man who must have been the very young man, the same young man that I've just said I hope would die. And they asked him to tell his story in his own words. Well, he began to tell his story. He said he was on the 52nd day of his hunger fast. He had lost the sight in both eyes, and the prison authorities told him he had only a few more days to live. His mother had called in the Roman Catholic priest to administer the last rites of the church. And as the priest was praying over this young man, his mother began to cry. And she said to him, I'm not going to allow you to do this. I'm not going to allow you to die. She said, I'm an old woman and I've lived my life. And I don't care what the IRA do to me. But you're a young man and you've done dreadful things. But I still have faith in you. She said, I believe there's something worthwhile about you. And I'm going to the authorities and I'm going to ask them to take you off this fast immediately and take you to the hospital and force feed you. Now he knew that if she took that step, that his mother and his whole family could be in grave danger from the IRA, who wouldn't like that. So he said to her, Mother, don't do it. I'll do it. You call in the warders and I'll tell them that I want to be taken off this fast. So he told them and they took him to a hospital where he was put on a drip and he was fed for several weeks. He regained his sight and began to feel better. And he said that the first night he was put back into his prison cell, it had all been fumigated, repainted, all new furniture put in because he had destroyed his own furniture. He even had new pajamas and he just had a shower. And he said he felt so fresh and clean and glad to be alive that he got down on his two knees on the floor and he thanked God that he hadn't died. He thanked God that God had given him another opportunity. And he said, Dear Father, would you take over my life and make something of it? Help me to do some good with the rest of my life. Well, he remembered that in his locker there had been a Gideon Bible. And he was reading it during the first days of the fast when he had nothing else to read. And as he got weaker, he threw it to one side and thought it was useless anyway. So he went and looked in the locker and the Gideon Bible was still there. He opened the Bible just anywhere because he wasn't very familiar with it. And he read the words that I read earlier tonight, that we have to love our enemies. Bless them that persecute you. And he said, Father, you better teach me how to love Protestants, because I don't know how to. He said, since I was a little boy, I was taught to hate Protestants. I thought it was normal and natural. Would you teach me how to love them? And he said that for the first night in years, he had a good night's sleep. He slept like a baby. And the next morning, the warders came, and they opened up the doors on his side of the prison. These were all the IRA. And he said when they opened the doors on the other side, they were the loyalist UDA. And every morning when they came out, he used to think, I wish I had a gun. I'd finish every one of them all. But that morning he said he came out, and he felt such love for them that he thought, why, they're my brothers. And I haven't known it. We're all God's children, and we have more in common. There's more to unite us than there is to divide us. And he made a point that day of going up and speaking to a couple of his Protestant inmates in the jail. And they told him about this little group called the Soldiers of the Cross. And he became a member of this group. And they were now doing good work. Well, as he was telling his story, he was sobbing. He was crying so hard that we could hardly hear him speak. And I don't mind admitting, but I was sobbing with him for daring ever to condemn any man to death. for daring to ever say that any man on this earth was beyond redemption. And then I began to see that while I and thousands of other people were praying that he would die, that somewhere in that dark night, someone was praying, his mother. And I realized there's no love on this earth like a mother's love. And a mother's love is the nearest thing to God's love. Because a mother always sees good in her children. And I prayed, Father, teach me what that love is like. Because my love's too limited. My love says, I love you if you're good. Or I love you if you conform to what I think is good. But if you don't do that, I won't love you. And that's not love at all. God's love is totally unconditional. He says, I love you no matter what. Because he sees the good that's there underneath the surface. Just like that mother saw in her son. And I felt such love for that young man that although I've never met him, I really felt that he's one of my dearest friends. Because from there on, I decided that I was going to study and pray to find out what that love was like and to ask God to help me to become more loving, to become like him. God is love. And there's no one in this world that he loves more than he loves you. Each and every one of you are so precious in his sight. You're unique to him. He needs you. And no matter what your problem is, no matter how big it seems, or insurmountable, or how long it's lasted, it's not beyond his loving care. And the way to solve it is to begin to know, first of all, that God is love. That he loves, that he cares, and that you can trust yourself to him. That he needs you, each and every one of us, to put off this old selfhood, to love our neighbors as ourselves, to heal the world through love, and help to establish the kingdom of heaven right here, right now, on earth. Now the final part of this talk and environment, because you know we could talk about this for a week, this environment situation, is when we seem to be environed inside a material body and we think there's no way of escape. Perhaps it's an incurable disease or a chronic disease, something that has happened and there just doesn't seem to be any answer to it, even though you've prayed and prayed and prayed. Let me tell you, you should never give up. About 18 months ago, I was introduced to a young woman who was suffering from a disease called ME. I'm sure you've all heard about it. Something that wastes away the muscles. She'd had this disease for 7 years. When I met her, she'd been bedridden, completely bedridden, for over a year. She'd been to many, many doctors who had tried everything to help her, and they'd reached the stage where they didn't know what else to do. They told her husband it was just hopeless. There was nothing that they could do for her. They were giving her so many drugs that she couldn't eat.
and she'd lost so much weight and was so weak that she couldn't even hold the telephone. It had to be propped up on a pillow. Now, she was the mother of three children. Two of them were teenagers, and the youngest one was only 11. And for all those years, the environment in their home was not good. Her husband was a very busy, popular journalist. He was also the author of 9 books, a very busy young man. But when he came home from work every day, he had to cook meals, take the children shopping, see to all the things his wife couldn't see to, and she had to have someone there every day looking after their home. And she just couldn't stop crying. She said, when I went to see her, she said, "Why is this? Why should I have to die and leave my children when they need me so much?" She asked me if Christian Science could heal her, because she had tried many faith healing groups and everything in medicine, and nothing had helped. Well, I offered to pray for her. I went to visit her for 3 consecutive days, and every day when I went to visit her, she kept telling me about the disease, what she'd suffered from it, how it started, all the symptoms. She went over them and over them and over them. On the 3rd day, I said to her, "This disease is called ME. Now, ME means me. And for 3 days, you've done nothing but talk about me. This mortal, physical me, which isn't really you at all." So I said to her, "I would like to talk to you about you, a wonderful you that God made, that God knows, that God loves." And we began with the first chapter of Genesis, where God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. We read different things about man from the Christian Science textbook. We began to identify her correctly, and she began to respond very slowly at first. We read verses in the Bible like, "I shall not die, but live, and declare the works of the Lord. And I will restore to you the years that the locust had eaten." I saw that this woman needed her faith in God restored, because it had taken an awful beating. She'd had a good religious upbringing, but her faith in God seemed to have taken a beating. And we began to talk about God and how God is love. Well, in a few days, her husband had to go outside the country for 5 days, and he didn't know what to do with his wife because she didn't want to go into hospital. And I said that I would take her home. And I took her home, and during those 5 days, we did nothing but talk about man's perfection and about this God who is love. And I'm pleased to be able to tell you that when her husband came home, she ran down the steps to meet him. And within a week, she was driving her own car. And the first night that they all went out together as a family, they went to the supermarket. And then they went for a meal together and sat round the table together for the first time as a family. And on their way home, they called to see me with an arm full of flowers. And her husband, with tears in his eyes, said to me, "I never thought I would be so happy to simply push a shopping trolley round the supermarket." He said it was the most wonderful thing. Their whole environment took on a whole new look. Life became wonderful. She and her husband used to get in the car, drive down to the sea, buy an ice cream and sit like 2 kids and eat it, just for the joy of living and being together. What a change in their environment. She didn't have to die or get out of her body. She had only to change her false concept of God and of herself. And you know, what's true for one is true for all. Pray with the Lord's Prayer, because that has such power, and give God the glory.